this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm super excited today. We have a studio full of Enquirer reporters, along with producer Phil, who's wearing a toque today, even though it's nice and warm in the studio, always, probably too warm, because we are going to talk about not the most important stories that the Enquirer did this year, because we did some very important Big J journalism that saved the world, led to new laws, got people fired. No, we're going to pander to the interests of our audience, because we know what you read thanks to all the digital analytics we have. So we're going to talk about some of the most read local stories of the year. So with me in studio, we have David Ferrara, we have Aaron Glenn, we have Cam Knight, and back again, well, you always sneak
somehow
in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, Casey Sloan, who's the unofficial co-host now of the podcast, by the way. I think she's earned that.
Thank you.
To talk about some stories you wrote. So welcome, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks Hello. For having us.
See, they're really here in the studio. Now, I should say that we have a caveat, because we're going to focus on some of the most read, specifically local stories, because we did have some crazy stories take off that weren't entirely local. The biggest story, the most read story on Cincinnati.com this year was a story about the TSA adding something to the banned item list that you can put in your checked bags. You know, you're not supposed to put like lithium batteries in your checked luggage because it can like blow up in the cargo hold. Added to the list was cordless hairstyling equipment, like curling irons that are powered by butane. Cam, have you heard of such a thing?
I've never heard of such a thing.
Cam doesn't have much hair, so that makes sense. What about the ladies here? Have you ever used a butane-powered hairstyling device?
My stuff just plugs into the wall.
Yeah.
It's got a cord.
I avoid butane. It's a rule.
Rule of thumb.
Another story that I'll say it was local because it was interesting to local people. This story got close to 1 million page views, and it started because while we were covering all things inauguration related because of J.D. Vance, and we do have the J.D. Vance related story on the most read list as well. Do you guys remember what it was?
Was it a beard?
No. The story was, how tall is Barron Trump?
Yeah, that was my guess.
That was your guess?
Yeah, because I wrote it.
Which I love when this happens, when we are, you know, when we're in the process of doing our jobs and we're having a conversation about something that's curious, that we're curious about. I like when those become stories. So someone saw Barron standing next to his parents, towering above his dad, Donald, and Donald's not exactly short. So we did that story, how tall is Barron Trump? Got nearly 1 million page views. And the answer to the question, anyone? How tall is Barron Trump?
Do you want me to? I can
take a guess. You probably looked it up.
6'9".
6'9". Wow. 6'9".
Yeah.
He's a big boy. All right. Yeah. But you guys are here because we want to talk about a few stories. And we're also going to patch in Kelsey Conway a little bit later. She's going to talk about one of the biggest sports stories, and that's Joe Burrow's turf toe. She is, as we record, just got her bag. I hope it didn't have a butane-powered curling iron in it. She just flew back from Miami. What a tough gig going to Miami in December. Where the Bengals just swamped all over the Miami Dolphins. So she's going to talk about turf toe. Casey, you did a story about Usha Vance.
I did, yes.
And then Aaron, you did a story which was sort of one of the local fallouts or local reaction to the Charlie Kirk assassination, which was one of the biggest stories of the year nationally. But there was some local fallout that you're going to talk about. Cam, you're here to talk about the brawl.
The never-ending. The story's not over.
It's not over, the 4th Street brawl. And then finally, David, you and Victoria Morwood, who's on vacation, covered a lot of the, I don't know, the controversy, the reality, the data into Sheriff Richard Jones's decision to lease space to ICE at the Butler County Jail to detain, for ICE to detain people that have any kind of immigration situation. So that was an ongoing story, multiple stories, but you guys did, I think, one of the best, if not the best, data-driven stories about who is really being detained there. So we'll get into that. But I'm going to start with, I think, you, Cam, the brawl. Take us back to the summer, or to July of 2025.
July of 2025, we were in the thick of it. The election season was starting to ramp up for the mayor. And there had already been a lot of talk about nationally, about particularly cities with liberal administrations not being hard enough on crime. And then the downtown brawl happened, and it went viral, and Elon Musk tweeted about it. There was all sorts of, Donald Trump Jr., I think, tweeted about it. It went crazy.
And the backdrop is you have the Trump administration sending National Guard forces into some of these democratically led cities where, according to Trump, crime is running rampant to help
Correct.
Local law enforcement.
Yeah.
So if you don't know about this brawl, you were probably not paying attention to any local news this year. It was inescapable.
It touched on race. It touched on crime data. It touched on whether the perennial question of whether downtown is safe or not.
And it was especially a big question heading into summer because there were some high profile attacks, you know, teenagers kind of running around indiscriminately yep. attacking people at different places, violence at the banks.
There had already been sort of a direct indictment of the city administration by Sarah Herringer, whose husband was killed in his own home in downtown earlier in the summer. And she kind of went on the offensive early, and then this just compounded it.
So this, give us the elevator explanation of the brawl.
Based on
now with all the time we've had to view other, you know, view additional videos and.
Well, I say all this with the caveat that none of the trials that have been started and none of the people who've been charged related to this have been their trials are still ongoing. It's all in flux. The complete story of what happened probably comes down to the words people said to each other and the motives that people had after people said different things to them. But there's about a million different views of what happened on video, and there was a dispute between two groups of people. There was a group of three or so people who included a man named Alex Travinsky, who would go on to be charged, another white male, and a white female who was seen in the videos being appearing to be knocked out or nearly knocked out in the videos. And then there were a lot of at least eight people have been charged with felonies related to this, and they are all black. So that brought out some of the worst of what social media has to offer in people commenting about this.
And just to kind of establish the timeline, the night of the brawl, it seemed like, if not for a viral video that went viral nationally, just another night, drunk people out on the street,
right?
Some pushing, some shoving, some fighting. But
yep. And it tied into the Cincinnati. Well, it's the Cincinnati Music Festival,
right?
It's called now, but it was formerly called the Jazz Festival.
But the first glimpse we had of this brawl was what looked to be a group of black people attacking a white man and then a white woman in another video. So bad look. fodder for all kinds of people to spout off their theories on social media. Then we learned a little more. You know, Alex T, we internally were calling him the slapper because there was some, the attorney for some of the individuals who are facing felony charges in a news conference said that video was going to show that Alex T started the whole thing by slapping somebody, using the N-word. And as you said, Cam, a lot of this is going to be sorted out, I think, when some of these trials begin.
For sure. For sure. But I mean, at the end of the day, what it really brought into question wasn't so much, I think people were less worried about what happened and more worried about is our city safe? Are we becoming a lawless, urban center that is going to end up spiraling into, no businesses, no commerce because people are scared to come here? And I think largely the crime data did show a spike in crimes in the urban core of Over the Rhine and downtown. But it was compared to a decade ago, nothing extravagant, nothing too high. And in the rest of the city, crime was down in many, many, many different ways. So it's in fact, we're on pace to have a very, very low year for shootings this year. So so it was sort of a battle of wills when it came to who was right about what, and perception versus reality. And I think the city administration, while they sometimes in the past have leaned on the numbers show this is reality, the city administration acknowledged that if people don't feel safe downtown, that's an issue. And they did do a lot to try to address that.
So you already foreshadowed this a little bit, but looking ahead to next year, that's when we see the trials. Are you anticipating? Well, let's, before we wrap this, before we put a nice bow on this, you mentioned that Alex T was arrested. He was not, or charged. He was not charged originally. There, you said eight individuals facing various degrees of assault, felonious assault,
aggravated riot. Yeah,
those charges.
Yep.
There was sort of an outcry that none of the white people involved were charged. And so a misdemeanor charge suddenly came into play for Alex T.
Right. Alex Travinsky.
Yes.
Correct.
And so, and again, this was an extremely controversial move because some said this was purely politics. It was the city administration putting pressure on the prosecutors because of outcry by some leaders in the black community. And again, it's just a misdemeanor charge. So it, in my right. view, it didn't do anything, but may, if you were already angry he wasn't charged, you got even more angry because it was just a misdemeanor charge. If you were of the belief that he was an innocent victim that really didn't provoke that kind of a beatdown, then you were pissed off because
He's facing charges at all.
So it's still a mess is what you're trying to say.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So and we're not done with this story.
And by all indications, the Alex Travinsky's lawyer has made it clear he intends to it would be very common in a situation with a person facing misdemeanor assault for them to take a plea deal for a lesser charge or for them just to plead guilty and pay a fine with the promise of no jail time or something like that. And but Alex's lawyer has made it clear he plans to fight this to the bitter end. So he I think that case could very well go to trial this year. We will likely be covering a misdemeanor assault trial, which is something that we would normally never pay attention to.
That's interesting. Yeah, for people to understand that. Okay, well, Cam, I trust you'll be all over this. You already have your marching orders for next year. Let's switch to Aaron now. Aaron, you cover Hamilton County. You cover the commission. You've written a lot about the Bengals lease. You've written a lot about what the commissioners have been up to this year. But this was a little bit of a different story for you. for sure.
I guess it fell into the regional politics part of the beat.
Well, let's talk about that. So let me set it up. We had the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and once the what I would call the active shooter story was resolved, and the shooter was found, it didn't take the country very long to turn it into, to wield it politically. And it also, I think, was a true test of what type of speech we're comfortable with in this country, in this politically charged, politically divided nation we're in. And so if you are on social media, which, I think if you're on it at all, you could not escape people weighing in on,
right,
you know, giving their opinion about the Kirk assassination. So there's the setup. What happened?
So a Cincinnati resident made a Facebook post kind of mourning Charlie Kirk. And then Aaron Sharp, who is the co-owner of the Lucius Q Barbecue Restaurant, which has locations in Pendleton and in Factory 52 and in TQL Stadium, he commented on that Facebook post and said, "Good riddance, what a piece of shit."
This, are you allowed to say that on this podcast, Bill?
I hope we can bleep that out. This immediately got a lot of pushback. There were 4,000 comments on the restaurant's Facebook page criticizing Sharp. He made his own Facebook page private after getting a lot of critical comments. And then it became not just a social media firestorm, but TQL Stadium announced that they didn't want to have Lucius Q as a vendor. One of the restaurant's meat vendors at Findlay Market said that they wouldn't be working with the restaurant anymore. Factory 52 said that they didn't want to have Lucius Q as part of their lineup. And then the restaurant announced that they were severing ties with Sharp. And as far as I know, Sharp didn't make any kind of statement after the fact. I know that we reached out to him multiple times in a few different ways. But yeah, that's kind of where things stood. I think that was our most high profile incident of somebody making a statement about Kirk's death.
Yeah. So one of the things that this brings up, which I think might be interesting to some of our listeners, is the threshold that we have when it comes to reporting on social media, what do you want to call it? When the controversy exists on social media and, you know, people are commenting with reckless abandon and people are getting canceled and all of that stuff. We don't normally go, wade into those waters unless, this is what Jackie Borchert likes to say, unless there's real world impact. Like if it bleeds out and if it's affecting the real world, not just the virtual world where everybody can, flex and scream at each other. But you already rattled off, like there was some significant, air quote, real world reactions and impact that happened, not the least of which was his partners in the restaurant saying that they were no longer, that he was no longer part of the group.
Right.
And this was after they lost their contract at TQL Stadium, after they lost one of their suppliers. You went down the list already. For the group, is that where we are as a society? I thought this country was founded on free speech. You don't have to like what people say. And everybody has the right to sound stupid, right? To say stupid things. But how do we feel about what happened to him?
Well, I mean, free speech is about protection from government retaliation, right? I think everyone can agree it's in bad taste when someone is murdered to celebrate a murder. But I mean, this wasn't a case of the government retaliating against Sharp. It was just his business relationships.
And I answered a few reader emails to that very point. People emailing saying, you know, you are the newspaper. You are a member of the Fourth Estate. You live and die by the protections in the First Amendment and free speech. Why aren't you coming to this guy's rescue? And to your point, a local business, TKO Stadium, they can do whatever they want. If the government came after him for what he said, then yeah, that would be a free speech issue. But no, like all of us here that, you know, we work in an at-will state where none of us are under contract with our employer. I could say something right now and I could be gone tomorrow and the government would have nothing to say about it. So that's an important point from the story. But what about just like, you know, do you think it was an overreaction? Do you think that that this was such a politically charged thing that there was no hope for him? If, like, I guess I'll ask it this way. Do you think there would have been blowback at TQL Stadium, or do you think there would have been blowback at the restaurant itself had they not ejected him?
I mean, I think we, when we talk about the online world bleeding into the real world, getting piled on online has real world consequences. So had it gone either way, and had they had a group online decided to pile on and give bad reviews to the restaurant for 6 months straight and flood their reviews, and you know, that could have had a real world consequence too. So it's a weird gray area that we live in these days, where we talk about the virtual world, but then what does that mean? There's a more gray than I'd like there to be.
We're getting really deep right now.
Well, that's one of the beautiful gifts of social media, right? Is, you know, these statements that you can make can have a very lasting impact beyond your intended audience. You might post something on your personal page and intend for just your few folks to see it, and then someone could screen grab it, post it out elsewhere. You see that even happening recently this week with a local bakery that posted a comment on an article, and then that got way beyond what I would assume might have been an intended audience. And there's different degrees of...
And issued an apology.
And issued an apology. That's had a real world.
If you want to look that up, impact. Folks, it's the puke emoji story. So, yes, we shouldn't be putting the puke emoji story when we're talking about people different from us, right? Is that the moral of that story?
Yeah, essentially, yes.
All right. Well, David Ferrara, you and Victoria have been all over what has been going on with the ICE lockup at the Butler County Jail. You know, it was a little bit controversial when it started, and Sheriff Jones doesn't shy away from controversy. In fact, prior to this even happening, he erected a sign in front of the jail, big old, like, you know, like a municipal sign, like you would see, that says illegal aliens here, with an arrow pointing to the jail. He's brazen. He's almost like he loves being a lightning rod for that. And he has been pretty outspoken when it comes to his support of the Trump administration's crackdown on all kinds of immigration issues, willingly went under contract with ICE so the jail could serve as a detention facility. The question you and Victoria wanted to answer with your story was based on the initial comments from the president and the administration that this enforcement effort was going to target, quote, the worst of the worst criminals. What did you find when you actually looked at the data?
That's right. One of the largest parts of President Donald Trump's agenda when he was running for the presidency was this immigration heavy focus. And what we found as we started to look through the data of the people who were being detained at Butler County by ICE and either being apprehended by local authorities and then having a detainer placed on them by ICE to say, hey, hold them for us, is that most of the people who are being held do not have any criminal convictions. And the way that ICE codes this in their data is basically three ways. Either somebody has a criminal conviction on their record somewhere in the country that they've been able to identify. They have some form of pending criminal charge, which could range as to as serious an offense as murder to as minor an offense as a traffic ticket. And whether they have just an immigration violation. So you have these three different options. And we found that only one third of the people who have been detained in Butler County actually have a criminal conviction. And the vast majority have what are just primarily immigration violations, which is just entering the country illegally by way of violating the policies of immigration, which isn't actually under the federal law a crime. It's more of a civil offense.
And just to put a sharper point on that, a lot of this is semantics. If you are a supporter of the president, you are very loose with the term criminal. So if some, and you'll use terms like illegal alien. So if someone enters the country illegally, that is a crime. If someone enters the country and they later on have some kind of issue with their status, that's not a criminal violation. It's different than, you know, so we have to be kind of be precise in our language. And we always try to be with any story we do, particularly when it comes to immigration stories. But again, you've got a politically divided country, a politically divided community, and you have a lot of people using those terms to advance their own agenda. So one of the things you guys had to do is be super precise with like the definition of some of these terms and the definitions and, you know, again, relying on the data to show what exactly, you know, the data shows in terms of what kind of criminal background the detainees in Butler County have.
That's right. And you know, one of the things that we but kind of drove our reporting in this story was that ICE and immigration enforcement has gotten a lot of attention this year. And that's by intent. I mean, you know, as you said, Sheriff Jones is very outspoken and all that about his approach to immigration, but so is the president. So is his administration. That's part of fulfilling the mandate that they believe that they were elected to fulfill. And you know, a lot of this has been going on for many years. You know, ICE isn't a new agency. Immigration enforcement isn't a new tactic, but the approach has been different. The way, the scale, the speed, the rate at which people are being detained, we're noticing in the data is increasing. And that was an opportunity for us to explore that in an actual quantifiable way and say, okay, here's the impact this is having on the local Cincinnati community and on the region, and putting some more facts and numbers to what is a very politically charged issue.
And I think that's important because I think if you don't, and I, this is one of the stories I'm super proud that we did, because a lot of news organizations in this town don't have the depth and expertise that we bring to some of these topics. And so, again, I don't think anyone's opinion on, you know, immigration or what the current administration is doing changed based on our reporting. But I think what it did show was that if you were led to believe because of the rhetoric that people with immigration issues are all violent criminals, you know, drug lords, rapists, murderers, that's some of the language that has been used by President Trump.
Right.
The reality is, at least in this area, and at least at the detention facility in Butler County, you've got a third of the detainees that actually have what you would call a criminal conviction. And of those, the percent that was actually a violent criminal conviction was pretty low, too. Most of the, what were some of the...
So a little of that, some of that was difficult for us to be able to actually ascertain, but what we were able to do is look at the most serious conviction, and we found that only 16% were actually convicted for violent crimes. So when you take that worst of the worst, you know, language that's being used, the data doesn't reflect that that's who's actually getting picked up.
So basically 16% of the subset of like roughly 30%.
Correct.
Yeah. I think the story talked about traffic violations.
Right. And what we've learned too, as conversations that we've continued to have and reporting we've done with both Department of Homeland Security officials, as well as different immigration advocates and attorneys, is that a lot of these people who are getting picked up, ICE refers to them as collateral arrests, which is a way that they understand how all of these people are getting in that aren't necessarily violent criminals. They're targeting, they say they target the worst of the worst, but in doing so, there are people that end up getting arrested as they call collateral.
Yeah.
And those are people that might just have an immigration status violation, that might have pending criminal charges, but might be in the company of or wrong place, wrong time with someone that they are trying to target.
So big net.
Yes.
Big net. All right. Well, these are some downer topics, guys.
I know.
But I guess that's, you know, that's what news is. You know, we used to do market research back in the day, and we would ask people, how can we improve the Enquirer? And they were like, well, you're always so negative. We need more good news. So we'd actually like went on some good news initiatives. Had like way back in the day, a whole section in the Sunday paper called Good News. That's what it was called. Mm-hmm. And then the internet happened, right? And we could actually see what y'all are reading. I'm talking to you, our audience, like what you actually click on, what you spend time with. And you know what? It's all the mayhem. It's all the, yeah.
They live so for the drama.
That's just human nature, I guess. All right. So back to the inauguration. It was big news in Ohio, big news in Cincinnati when J.D. Vance became the vice presidential nominee, joined the ticket with Donald Trump. It's been a while since we've had anyone with Ohio ties in the White House, but Ohio has a great history, as we know, of former presidents. So there was a lot of interest in J.D. Vance beyond hillbilly elegy, which is a well-known story. But he has a home in Cincinnati and was, you know, frequently spotted around town at events. I actually ran into him at Blink a couple years ago when he was just Senator Vance. Mm-hmm. But a meteoric rise in politics. So there was a lot of interest in J.D. Vance, but we found, Casey, a lot of interest in the second lady, Usha Vance. So you did a little bit of reporting on some of her background. What did we learn about Usha Vance? Tell us a little bit about what people were interested in.
They were interested in, honestly, just who she is. I mean, she's the first Indian American second lady in the White House, and she's also the first Hindu second lady. So going from, you know, having Kamala running for president and having the potential first man in the office to having Usha, what we learned about her, she's from California. Her and J.D. Vance met at Yale Law School. She worked as a litigator, which has a national firm based in San Francisco. And they have three children together. And they also got married in Kentucky in 2014, a year after they graduated. And it was a Hindu. They had a separate Hindu ceremony.
I think some of the fascination with this is after they got married, JD himself really doubled down on his Christian faith, joined the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And so that has a lot of people wondering how they manage that in their marriage. And apparently she's, you know, not in a big hurry to convert.
He had previously said that she actually had told him to re-engage with his faith. But then also, like, what was it, a month ago, he had said that he hopes that she converts to Christianity. So, like, it sparked a whole debate and criticism online. So it's like, how are they making it work? Also, the rumors with him, and not really rumors, but like him getting friendly with Erica Kirk at Turning Point, all of these things. Usha wasn't wearing her wedding ring at one point. People picked up on that. So there's just a lot of questions surrounding the couple even today.
And I would say she seems like a very reluctant person to be in the spotlight. Like, that's
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And their children are all still very young.
think at the inauguration, their oldest was 7. They have a 7, 4, and 2-year-old.
And I think everybody could relate to his kid at the inauguration.
Paying attention. Yeah,
exactly.
And their daughter had the little Band-Aids on her fingers. I think Jackie had brought that up. She's like, why does she have Band-Aids on her fingers? They're like bluey or something.
And I think... And here we go with our in-depth reporting. there was no injury she sustained. Sort of like bribery for her to behave while she was on camera.
Honestly, anything. Yeah, it takes to get
like
a kid
she
to
wanted
sit
to
still.
Wear the Band-Aids, and they were like, "Okay, do we say no and risk a tantrum on national television, or does she just have to rock the bluey Band-Aids?"
Yeah, David wrote a story about it. She's wearing bluey Band-Aids on her fingers.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to go from fingers to toes. And so, as I said,
that was a good segue.
One toe in particular. So let's patch in Kelsey. All right. I think we got Kelsey on the line. Do we have Kelsey on the line?
I'm on the line.
All right. How was Miami?
Miami was great. It was 80 degrees. I didn't have to wear a coat to the game. The Bengals won. Everybody was happy in the locker room following the game. So it was a good trip all in all.
What a rare moment, a happy locker room this season.
I know. I said all we need is for the game to just go the way we need it to go. Nobody big get injured and that happened. So all good.
All right. Well, we're doing the most read stories of the year, and from the world of sports, from your world, it was no bigger story than turf toe. So for those who have been under a rock, give us the quick and dirty explanation of what happened to Joe Burrow. What was it, week 3?
Yes. No, week 2.
Week 2.
It was week 2. So it was a play in the Bengals home game against the Jacksonville Jaguars where Burrow was running, scrambling out of the pocket, and he hyperextended his toe so far that essentially his big toe and the ligament just tore. And so he went to go step and try and pivot out of the pocket. And sometimes if you overextend your foot like that and put too much pressure on your big toe, it can tear. And in classic, you know, Joe Burrow fashion, it's not just a grade 1. It had to be a grade 3 with him. And they knew coming off the field, I mean, he couldn't even put any weight on it. And so they took him back to the locker room, and within a couple hours, they were able to find out that it was a pretty serious turf toe injury. Like I said, there's different levels of it. And Joe, who's just had horrible injury luck in his career, had the worst, a grade 3 tear, and went and had surgery on it and then rehabbed back. And originally they had told him it was going to be a 3-month minimum timeline for him to be able to return. But, you know, as he's done almost his whole career, if you give him a timeline, he'll beat it. And he was able to come back in I think it was close to 9 to 10 weeks. So he beat the timeline and is now wearing a shoe that has a titanium plate in it to help make sure the structure of the cleat allows his toe to not go backwards, because he said that his toe is not allowed to go backwards yet. So that's kind of the whole story about turf toe and what it is. And you know, you don't really think about your big toe being so important, but it's very painful, and your big toe kind of controls the whole foot. So if you injure that at the level that Joe Burrow did, it can keep you out for a couple months.
Well, unfortunately, we're sort of used to Joe Burrow getting hurt. Torn ACL, the calf injury, one off season, he decided to have his appendix almost burst. And so he had to have, you know, appendectomy right before that slowed him down.
Then don't forget the wrist.
The wrist. Yeah. That was probably the most horrible one to watch, because before they took him out of the game, he was trying to throw and he just had.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the conversations after this happened was, you know, how did we end up with such, and I know he's a tough guy, he came back early, but like a seemingly injury-prone, fragile quarterback?
Well, so much of it, I mean, as you just said, is luck, and he's admitted, and this injury, I think, really changed Joe's perspective on everything when it comes to his career, and there's not a lot that he can do about some of these injuries. There are some small things that I think are going to be talked about following this season about, you know, can he get rid of the ball faster to not take as many hits? Because every time you get hit, there's an extra possibility of you getting injured. So I think that to some degree, he needs to consider that, and the Bengals need to enforce that, because they're a completely different team, as you've seen, without him on the field. But some of it is luck, and he has just been dealt a difficult hand in this aspect, and he's really had some tough conversations when he's done press conferences with us about just how difficult is this specific injury was for him, because there's only so many times you can motivate yourself from a mental standpoint to get through the rehab and come back and everything's going to be okay when you get back. And I think this one really took a toll on him. And I think it really opened his eyes to, and he said it last week, I asked him, he said, I have to figure out how to be more available to my team. And he's going to explore all of the options. And he, for as much as it is unfortunate luck, he is taking responsibility for it. And it sounds like he really does understand that he needs to do whatever he can to try and limit the amount of injuries that he's now had. And there's only so much of it he can do, but he does seem open to exploring different things that can maybe help him stay on the field more.
So the other element to this story and why it was such a fascinating season for Bengals fans is at first everyone was like, well, okay, we've been here before. We've got Jake Browning. He's like the best number two in the NFL. Mm-hmm. On any other team, he would be a starting quarterback. So he knows the offense. He's going to come in and pick up where Joe left off. And the opposite happened. He laid a big egg, so much so that all of a sudden, and you know, I don't follow the Bengals as much as some of the super fans, not nearly as much as you do. I would have never predicted Joe Flacco.
It's my job. I live it and breathe it. And I cover the NFL and watch the NFL when I'm not working. He was not one that I had even thought about as a possibility. No one thought that Jake Browning, as you just said, was going to have as bad of a season as he did. And, you know, when Joe's wrist surgery happened 2 years ago, that's what got the Bengals former offensive coordinator Brian Callahan a job, because of how well Jake Browning played. So no one, to your point, no one expected Browning to be as bad as he was. And then out of nowhere, after the third game, you kind of got the feeling when Zach Taylor wouldn't really commit to if Jake Browning was going to keep starting, you kind of got the feeling that they might have to make a trade for someone. But Flacco was not on the radar because 2 weeks before, the Bengals had gone up to Cleveland and beaten the Browns with Flacco starting, and he looked awful. So I think there were a lot of things that went into Flacco playing really well in Cincinnati that nobody could have predicted. The receivers are a big part of that, a good coach. But, I mean, you're exactly right. No one expected Flacco to end up being the Bengals quarterback. And, you know, kudos to the Bengals for going through all of their options and realizing he was the best one for what they needed. But yeah, the Jake Browning's turning into not, you know, I don't imagine he will be on Bengals roster as their backup quarterback next year, but that was definitely a surprise. And the Flacco, as you kind of mentioned, the Flacco storyline gave Bengals fans some joy in what was a really hard season.
Well, I'm kind of mad about the whole Philip Rivers comeback story because now we don't have the weirdest comeback story in the NFL. But still,
44 years old.
I know. and admittedly overweight, out of playing shape.
Yeah.
But there he is. Yeah. So what's, before we let you go, Kelsey, what's Joe Flacco's future?
Well, I've joked about it, but honestly, it doesn't seem that far-fetched that he will go become the starter for the Pittsburgh Steelers next year and complete his tour of being a starting quarterback for all of the teams in the AFC North, because that just feels fitting for his career. And I don't think Aaron Rodgers is going to be playing pass this year, so they do need a quarterback. But I don't envision he will be back in Cincinnati. I think he wants and believes he can still be a starter. Whether the league believes that or not, we'll see. But I don't envision him coming back to Cincinnati and saying, I want to end my career as a backup. I think that if he's not going to have a chance to be a starter for a team, it seems like that would be when he decides to finally retire. But, you know, who knows? Crazier things have happened. But I think that there might be one team that is just in such a bad situation where there's not, this year the draft is not full of good quarterbacks. So there might be a team out there that needs a quarterback that says, hey, you know what? We saw what he did with the Bengals and we're going to try and make this work here. But I think if he's not going to be a starter there, I think it's going to be time for him to retire. That's just based off my conversations with him and observing him in press conferences when asked about this. But he definitely still thinks and believes he can play, and it's kind of hard to argue against it with the way he played in Cincinnati.
All right. Well, if he ends up playing for Tomlin on the Steelers, I will buy you the malt of your choice at Grader's. We'll have a friendly bet.
Well, wouldn't that seem fitting, though, to end it with the AFC North tour?
I think you're right. All right. Well, thank you, Kelsey. We'll let you go.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. That was fun. But as you know, as is our want, it's a funny phrase, as is our want on the That's So Cincinnati podcast, we have to talk about anything that happened to you in the last week or so that is not just So Cincinnati, which, by the way, it is So Cincinnati that we had for a brief moment the weirdest quarterback story of the year, and then the whole Phil Rivers thing happened. But anyway, it has to be holiday related if you can. All right. So I'm going to start just to like give you time to think about it. It had been forever since I've seen A Christmas Carol, not just at Playhouse in the Park, but anywhere. Right. So my wife and I, we decided we were going to be intentional about like having a list of fun Cincinnati holiday things to do. And she had never seen A Christmas Carol, which she's from here. I can't believe that. Like, I think the first time I saw it, I went on a school field trip because I remember like rolling in on a big yellow bus to Playhouse in the Park. And anyway, I highly recommend it. I know this, I sound like a big homer, but we are so blessed with top-notch performing arts in this town of ours. And the cast, the choreography, the set design. If you haven't seen it, you need to go see A Christmas Carol. She was blown away, and you can still go because the hardest ticket to get is leading up to Christmas. The few days afterwards, it's going to run through Sunday, and the 27th and the 28th, that's Saturday and Sunday, are usually the easiest performances to get tickets for. And if you're on the website, this is my pro tip, and you're not seeing good seats, call them because the people in the box office have the current list of cancellations. And we scored some good seats that way. So that's my moment, man. I got all the Scrooge out of me. I'm feeling all like, you
jolly.
Know, yeah, jolly like running festive. Around, bestowing gifts on things. Anyway, who wants to go next?
I'll go.
Go, Aaron, go.
I was walking to Fountain Square after work last week and like happened upon, because I guess they move every year. It seems like they do, the Shillitoe's elves like in the windows. And I feel like that's the most Cincinnati thing is to not be looking for them and then see them on your walk. Because I was kind of
where did you see them?
I guess Fifth Street on the way to Fountain Square.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We had a couple stories about that. Yeah. I love the fact that I think 3CDC, that would be the Cincinnati Center City Development Corporation. They have taken over the mission of making sure they're about maybe 2-3 foot tall, kind of animated, weird puppet things.
Yeah, they look weird.
The stuff of nightmares. I mean, yeah, some of those vintage puppets and animatronics are like very scary.
Well, and I saw them in Findlay Market last year. So
you keep stumbling across them. There's people that make a day of this. Like that's their destination to go see the Shillitoe's elves, and you just keep stumbling across them.
Yeah, like good to see you guys again.
Oh, that's good.
That is good. What about you, Cam?
This weekend we went to Kings Island for their Winterfest. Fun. Which is a very Cincinnati thing to me. It was a place I didn't go a lot as a kid, but I'm like, we're indoctrinating our children into it. And like the children of any good journalist, my kids, we were waiting in line to see Santa, and they were preparing questions for him because they were going to grill him to see if he was the real Santa.
The interrogation of Santa.
Yeah. And so the first question my oldest asked him was, What's my name?
Ooh.
And he goes, and he gives him a kind of a made up sounding word, and he goes, no, my name's Lucas. And he goes, of course your name is Lucas. I gave you your name in Elvish. That's how you say your name in Elvish.
That's so
and
smart.
I was like,
this is not
man.
Some like first day on the job Santa.
Yep. It was all out. And then they have character actors around the park, and one of them is just dressed up to the nines in a Jack Frost costume, makeup, blue, sparkly. And my kids wanted a picture with him, and they walked up and they got a picture, and my kids both came back to me and they were like, Dad, he smelled like peppermint. And it was like they really went all out for the holidays.
A little kid and went to see Santa usually smelled like, you know, whiskey and cigarettes.
Yep. The mall Santa.
Yep. The mall Santa.
Yep.
That's great. Yep.
Big step up from Marlboro's. So.
What about you, David? New guy in town.
Yeah.
Swinging single.
Yeah, recently.
Living the life.
One of my buddies was visiting Cincinnati, so I figured I have to show him what it's like here. So we went down to the Elm Street Plaza, checked out the new ice skating rink, which is pretty fun. Good time. I only fell once. Proud to report.
Nice.
I only go ice skating once every like 5 years, so, you know, I got to get it in. And then I brought him to Skyline, give it a shot.
Oh, but that's perfect.
Sad to report that he did not enjoy it as much as I do. So well, it takes
it
some
is,
time.
It yeah. is, as they say, an acquired taste. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. That's good. All right, Casey.
Okay.
Bring us home.
Yeah. It's not something that I did, per se, in Cincinnati.
Are
but,
you a homebody?
Well, kind of, yeah. After getting home from Florida last week, I was like, it's way too cold to go and do anything. So every year I love watching the Saturday Night Live Christmas episode. And one of the skits, they did like a parody on Love is Blind, which is a reality TV dating show where couples date each other without ever meeting face to face. Like they don't know what they look like. And Nick Lachey, who is from Cincinnati, hosts the show. And at the end of it, they made a joke about him and was like, he's also in 98 Degrees, the boy band from the 90s. And they're like, just so you know, 98 Degrees is touring again, but we got turned down by the Sphere. So we're playing a venue in Cincinnati called The Cube. It's just a regular building, but they got nachos. And David and I were like, are they kind of poking fun at the heritage?
They just ripped Cincinnati. See, that's why we don't care. Because
no.
We know how good we have it here.
Yeah.
All right. So that's your holiday experience, watching Saturday Night Live?
Yeah. As soon as I heard Cincinnati, I was like, oh, my gosh.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad. Did you write that up?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, that's
this
good.
Morning.
All right.
Of course.
That's all I care about. Did you write that story? All right. Well, David Farrar, Aaron Glenn, Cam Knight, Casey Sloan, thank you for doing this podcast today. Casey, you have the honors of wrapping things up with me. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com. Our producer today, Phil Didion.
If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, give us a rating, and share with a friend who loves all things Cincinnati.
Finally, if you value local journalism, and I know you do, and haven't subscribed for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now is a great time. Just go to Cincinnati.com and click on the subscribe button to see a special offer for new subscribers.
Thanks again. See you next week.